And now, Robert Trout with the news, direct from the NBC Newsroom in New York, presented by Pillsbury. Today, great pies, delicious homemade pies, the kind every man gets tender-hearted about, are made with Pillsbury pie crust mix. Fresh apple pie, for instance. There are plenty of apples in the markets now, so bake the best apple pie you've ever eaten. Use Pillsbury pie crust mix. It's easy, it's quick. You just add water to the 9 full ounces of mix, and you turn out rich, tender crust, ample for a big two-crust pie. Get Pillsbury pie crust mix soon. See for yourself why it's America's largest selling pie crust mix. And now, Bob Trout with the latest news.
First, the baseball news. Cleveland lost and Boston won, so there's a tie for first place. The first tie in the history of the American League. The scores, Detroit 7, Cleveland 1, and Boston 10, the New York Yankees 5. The playoff game, tomorrow in Boston. This is a day of waiting in Europe, where the United Nations Security Council in Paris gets the case of the Berlin blockade tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock Paris time. The first question that comes up tomorrow is whether the Security Council should consider the case at all, and everyone expects the Russian delegates to fight hard to prevent the Security Council from debating the charges against Russia. And if the case is argued in the UN Security Council, Soviet Marshal Sokolovsky in Berlin has already announced that Russia will ignore any action the United Nations decides to take. The residents of Berlin are waiting as anxiously as anyone. Today, the Berliners were told the fuel shortage is getting worse. Starting tomorrow, no electricity for stores or shops between 4 and 9 in the evening. The Russian-controlled Berlin newspapers have discovered a new capitalist plot. They're attacking that American pilot who's been dropping handkerchief parachutes of candy to German children. The candy starts bloody battles among the children, the communist papers say. Secretary of State Marshall is doing his waiting among familiar scenes in France, visiting the First World War battlefields of San Miguel, where he fought first as a captain 30 years ago. Czechoslovakia is getting ready for a communist purge. The government is setting up camps for forced labor. And next week, new laws go into effect with penalties for a long list of offenses, from treason to insulting the communist president. Communist leaders in Italy are calling on all working people in Rome to strike tomorrow for 15 minutes as a show of support for Rome's municipal employees who've been out on strike for 2 weeks. And in Yugoslavia, an official communist newspaper says Russia's Cold War against Marshal Tito may start a great and serious shooting war between Eastern and Western Europe. Indonesian troops in the Dutch East Indies are closing in on the rebel communists who are dug into the mountains of Central Java. And there's a revolt in Ethiopia, but this one seems to have nothing to do with communists. Some Ethiopian tribesmen simply decided taxes are too high. A revolution on this side of the Atlantic, too. In Peru, sailors and armed civilians began an uprising in the big seaport of Callao near Lima. But the Peruvian army remained loyal to the government, which has announced that the revolt is crushed, the sailors fleeing out to sea in warships with Air Force planes after them. Here at home, we're into the final month of the political campaigns now. Governor Dewey is on his way home to Albany today, his first big speaking tour over. President Truman is already preparing to start out on another trip through the eastern states this time, beginning next Wednesday. And to repeat, the baseball news, Cleveland lost, Boston won, so the American League pennant race has ended in a tie to be decided in an extra game in Boston tomorrow. And now for Pillsbury, here's Arthur Gary.
Thank you, Bob Trout. Millions of women know Pillsbury pie crust mix makes perfect pies. It's America's largest selling pie crust mix. It mixes quickly, rolls out easily. It's fast. You just add water. The pie you bake has the rich flavor of fine shortening. Tender, light crusts with a warm brown color. The flaky kind of crust that cuts at the touch of a fork. Get a package of Pillsbury pie crust mix and bake a big, tender apple pie soon. Listen again next Sunday at this time for Robert Trout and the News, brought to you by Pillsbury. Greatest name in flour. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.
Living, 1948. Living, 1948.
brought to you each week at this time by NBC and its affiliated stations, feels impelled to depart from its announced schedule today to focus your attention upon five speeches made in the halls of the Palais de Chaillot in Paris during the current meeting of the General Assembly of the United Nations. Reason? Because these words, as of this tense moment on Earth, reflect in vivid outline the immediacy, the urgency of living 1948. We take our title from General Marshall's parting remarks as he left for the United Nations meeting in Paris 2 weeks ago.
Hope alone is not enough.
Here is your narrator, Clyde Cattell.
Greetings, America. Correction. Greetings, citizens of the world. For today, in the words of poet John Donne,
no man is an island entire of itself. Every man is a piece of the continent, a part of the main.
To the citizens of the world, to you, then, we address these preliminary remarks, and they go like this.
From a Paris once called gay, the voices of world statesmen this week have spoken for history. Some of us seem to hear behind these voices the ominous hoofbeats of the four horsemen of the apocalypse. Others feel that at least the atmosphere is cleared through a blunt statement of issues for the first time bluntly faced.
However that may be, this much is true. The impact of their words upon our deed and thought and that of others may weigh the balance of our fate. Because this is so, we on Living 1948 are going to represent the living words spoken during the 240 pregnant hours. Words that mark the climax and the mounting cleavage between East and West.
The stage itself encompasses a proscenium as wide as the world and as small as the intersection of a street between two worlds in the rubbled capital city of Berlin. Fate's cast of characters.
The United States does not wish to increase the existing tension. It is its wholehearted desire to alleviate that tension.
That is Secretary of State George Marshall of the United States. Next.
The United States government, from the policy to fight against oppressive forces, has passed over to a policy of expansion and realization of plans for world domination.
Andrei Vyshinsky, Deputy Foreign Minister of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. Then.
If we find in the end we cannot proceed on a world basis as we had hoped, we must proceed on a regional basis.
The Honorable Ernest Bevin of Great Britain, followed by...
We do not intend to allow ourselves to be deprived of our rights.
Foreign Minister Robert Schuman of France, and finally...
What is certain is that on the side of the great socialist Soviet Republic, there is no understanding of the Western world at all.
Paul-Henri Spaak, Foreign Minister of Belgium.
Let us imagine ourselves, then, in the great hall of the Palais de Chaillot. The man we last met at the Washington airport looks expectantly toward the chair as President Evatt calls the meeting to order.
I call upon the delegate of the United States of America.
Mr. President, fellow delegates, we are particularly happy to meet here in Paris. It is entirely fitting that this General Assembly, meeting in France, which fired the hearts of men with the Declaration of the Rights of Man in 1789, should consider in 1948 the approval of a new Declaration of Human Rights for free men in a free world. It is not only fundamentally wrong that millions of men and women live in daily terror of secret police, subject to seizure, imprisonment, or forced labor without just cause and without fair trial. But these wrongs have repercussions in the community of nations. Governments which systematically disregard the rights of their own people are not likely to respect the rights of other nations and other people, and are likely to seek their objectives by coercion and force in the international field.
Secretary Marshall reaffirms United States' faith in the United Nations, but says,
despite the cooperative action of most nations to rebuild peace and well-being, tension during the past year has increased. The leaders of the other nations are creating a deep rift between their countries and the rest of the world community. We must not allow that rift to widen any further, and we must redouble our efforts to find a common ground.
He lists the areas of conflict in the world today. Palestine, Korea, Greece, India, atomic energy control, disarmament, ending in a defense of the motive of the Western powers.
There is no plot among members of this organization to keep any nation or group of nations in a minority. The minority position is self-imposed. Any government which by deliberate action cuts itself off from the rest of the world becomes incapable of understanding the problems and policies of other governments and peoples. It would be a tragic error if, because of such misunderstanding, the patience of others should be mistaken for weakness.
With this veiled warning that the United States will remain firm, Secretary Marshall concludes with a direct statement of United States policy.
The United States does not wish to increase the existing tension. It is its wholehearted desire to alleviate that tension. But we will not compromise essential principles. We will under no circumstances barter away the rights and freedoms of other peoples. We earnestly hope that all members will find ways of contributing to the lessening of tensions and the promotion of peace with justice. The peoples of the earth are anxiously watching our efforts here. We must not disappoint them.
Accepting nations of the Eastern Bloc, at whom the mild but firm address is directed, the Assembly greets these final words with vigorous applause. It is Saturday now. Again, the Palais de Chaillot is packed with the delegates of the nations, and the sound of Chairman Evatt's gavel literally summons the world to attention.
I call upon the delegates of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics.
Можно легко предвидеть, что от эстрады генеральной сессии...
Now, Andrei Bashinsky, Deputy Foreign Minister of the Soviet Union, takes the rostrum. With the ears not only of the Russian peasant, but the French shopkeeper, the British miner, the American clerk. In fact, all the little men of the world upon him. And he introduces a resolution calling for the five major powers to reduce their armed forces by one-third within a year as part of a general program for world disarmament. He goes on.
It can be easily foreseen that from the rostrum of the General Assembly... the pompous and much promising speeches about international cooperation, peace and independence of the peoples, human rights and democracy will be as pronounced as before. The same as it has been done in previous sessions, and as it is being done in various commissions and committees of the United Nations Organization. But we know that at the same time, feverish activity, which has nothing in common with the interests of defense, or peace of these countries is being carried out backstage of the United Nations Organization, in various headquarters, and in the military offices of the United States, Great Britain, and a great number of other countries that rotate within the orbit of Anglo-American influence.
He states that Russia was solely interested in rehabilitation and further development of a national economy disrupted by war. He recalls the time when Russia and America were allies fighting against aggression and fascism, and states that American foreign policy has changed over the past several years.
The United States government, from the policy to fight against aggressive forces, has passed over to a policy of expansion and the realization of plans for world domination. Open support in various countries of the most reactionary monarcho-fascist regimes and groups, and rendering to them aid with money and armament for the suppression of the democratic national liberation movement in these countries. Organization of military alliances, construction of new military air and naval bases, unchecked propaganda for a new war against the Soviet Union and the new democracies of Eastern Europe, a wild race of armaments, true worship of the atomic bomb as allegedly a means of escape from all the dangers and misfortunes threatening the capitalist world. These are the characteristic features of the foreign policy of the United States of America.
Mr. Vyshinsky attacks the new five-nation Western alliance and restated Russia's fear of a re-strengthened German state. He intimates the Russian suspicion that America may be considering Germany as a buffer state against the East.
The United States government, together with the governments of Great Britain and France, has organized, as is known, a military political bloc of five states, which does not hold as its aim the prevention of German aggression, and rendering mutual assistance against such aggression. It indeed cannot pursue such an aim, but even intends to include Western Germany, which since time immemorial has been the stronghold of German militarism and which has but recently served as a bulwark for Hitlerite aggression. Such treaties as the Treaty of Military Alliance of the Western States, including Great Britain, France, Belgium, the Netherlands, and Luxembourg, have in mind not only Germany, but can in the same way be directed against those states which have been allies during the Second World War.
Reaction to Vyshinsky's speech, the East applauded, the West was silent. Now it is Monday, and another great power rises to take a stand.
I call upon the delegate of the United Kingdom.
To the rostrum marches Ernest Bevin, Britain's foreign minister. 2 days earlier, he had stated British foreign policy in strong terms to the House of Commons in London. But before the General Assembly, he remains calm. He begins by clarifying Britain's position on the conflicts in the world. And suddenly, in the middle of his speech, he sounds the keynote of his address.
If the black fury, the incalculable disaster of atomic war should fall upon the world, one power, by refusing its cooperation in control and development of these great new forces for the good of humanity, will alone be responsible for the evil which may be visited upon mankind. This lack of cooperation has almost never been absent at any level of international political activity.
The British Foreign Minister then turns to the proposal introduced by Vyshinsky for one-third disarmament and atomic control.
Mr. Vyshinsky must forgive us if we are suspicious. As you all know, his country is a sealed book. No one knows what is happening. We are invited to put our security in a pool with a nation which will not and is determined not to reveal to the world what it is doing.
Bevin states that there was no aggression in the mind or heart of Britain's government, but that she must look to her own defense in the event of threats from elsewhere.
I was neither impressed or edified by the attack on the United States. If the representatives of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics have any feeling for the simple people of Europe or of the world, if they are animated by anything but an out-of-date, backward, unscientific doctrine, they would be the first to applaud the great and unselfish contribution to world recovery that has been made. We may still have time to learn the way to provide the means to overcome difficulties such as we now see revealed. But if we find that in the end we cannot proceed on a world basis as we had hoped, we must proceed on a regional basis. We must agree with whom we can agree, work with whom we can work, understand and trust those who are willing to enter into trust and understanding with us. It may be, after all, that if world government cannot come as we had hoped out of these very regional structures to which we may now turn, there may yet grow that world government for which humanity yearns and for which it has been striving and struggling for so long.
Again, the assembly chamber is filled with applause. Again, the East and West is split, the West applauding vigorously, the East remaining silent. Monday becomes Tuesday, and on that day, Foreign Minister Schumann of France presented the stand of his government.
Étant donné que nous n'avons nullement l'intention...
France was against the refitting of Germany for possible aggression, but he supported the Germans' right to economic progress and a democratic government. He states his country's position on the problem of Berlin.
As we do not intend either to allow ourselves to be deprived of our rights or to abandon populations entrusted to our care, we now, after 2 months during which we exhausted every possibility of direct agreement, appeal to the United Nations to settle these disputes and put an end to an act of force represented by the blockade imposed and maintained by Soviet authority.
The French Foreign Minister concludes by expressing his country's support for the European Economic Federation. There is time out for lunch, and finally, that afternoon, a distinguished representative of one of the small nations of Europe is called to the rostrum.
call upon the delegate of the Kingdom of Belgium.
Paul-Henri Spaak comes forward, a moderate socialist and first president of the General Assembly. Extemporaneously, he delivers his speech in French.
Les orateurs qui ont pris la parole au cours de ce débat général ont maintes fois remarqué...
And when referring to the Russian representative, turns and faces them directly.
Orators who have taken the floor earlier in this general debate have several times emphasized the atmosphere of heavy uneasiness in which our work has begun. How could it be otherwise after so many hopes have been frustrated and with so many problems remaining unsolved?
Mr. Spaak characterizes the mood of the assembly as grave and sorrowful. He echoes Ernest Bevin by declaring that the Western countries have nothing to reproach themselves for.
It is we who want the free movement of men. It is we who want, above all, free circulation of ideas. It is we who are ready to submit all our politics, actions, purposes, and ideals to examination and judgment. It is not we who shut ourselves behind an iron curtain. We wish to pierce the curtain, to know and understand, and having understood, undertake to reach a rapprochement and collaborate.
Russia says Spaak has no understanding of the Western world. Vyshinsky's speech, he contends, proved this again.
Perhaps it will seem immodest that a representative of a small country like Belgium wishes to answer that statement of the Soviet Union. But after all, perhaps it is preferable that a representative of a small country should answer the Soviet Union, as nobody can find in my attitude any idea of provocation whatever. Belgium provoking the USSR would be too ridiculous.
Quickly, he tackles Vyshinsky's charge of warmongering in the Western countries.
Mr. Vyshinsky cried out, and with what passion, against certain articles that appeared in the American press giving distances from Western air bases to Russian targets. What revelations, gentlemen! And what warmongering propaganda to indicate in such precise terms the distance from London to Moscow. I want to ask the honorable delegate of the Soviet Union one question. Can he assure me that the Soviet General Staff has never calculated the distance from Moscow to London?
Now the legality of the five-power alliance of the West is defended as completely proper according to the United Nations Charter. And then the Belgian representative turns squarely towards the Soviet bench, a bench empty of top-rank men. He points his finger at those seated there, and his voice, trembling with emotion, cries,
"The Soviet delegate need not look for complicated explanations of our policy. I will tell him what is the basis of our policy, in terms perhaps slightly cruel, but the only ones a representative of a small nation can use. Do you know what is the basis of our policy? It is fear of you, fear of your government, fear of your policy. Do you know why we are afraid? We are afraid because you often talk of imperialism. What is imperialism? It is a people, generally a great power, that makes conquests and increases its influence throughout the world."
He charges the Soviet with repeated acts of obstruction. Russia, he says, has put its own will above the rule of the majority of the world's nations. And then he adds a serious charge not previously aired before the United Nations.
"Finally, you make us uneasy because in every one of the countries represented here, you maintain a fifth column alongside which Hitler's fifth column was but an organization of Boy Scouts. There is no place in the world where one of the governments represented here, whether in Europe, in Africa, or in Asia, does not encounter some difficulty without your being there to inflame it. This is your manner of collaborating with governments represented here, with whom you should be working to assure peace."
Spaak charges that the communist parties of the world, in their opposition to the Marshall Plan, are an obstacle to world recovery.
"Oh, I am under no illusions. I know that tomorrow morning, in part of the world's press, I will be called a valet of American imperialism sold to Wall Street. But I will tell you, that the position taken by the USSR and by the communist parties of the whole world against the Marshall Plan constitutes the most depressing, the most serious, and the most disquieting action possible. For it is the truth proclaimed by 16 European nations, which need, after all, take no lessons from anyone on national dignity, that without the Marshall Plan, Europe is lost.
He quotes from Secretary Marshall's original statement proposing the Marshall Plan. This is the motivation behind Western action, he says, not the plot as charged by Russia. And now comes his last plea, a moving plea for understanding.
I know what inestimable service could be done the world if we were to be freed from fear. And I add that in this liberation from fear, the Soviet Union could, if it would permit me to tell it, play a great role, a decisive role. We do not ask only that we be told categorically that one is for peace and against imperialism, that one is for the United Nations Charter. We want to see these words translated into acts, and we want to see a beginning in our assembly of real collaboration based on understanding and mutual respect. Let us make this effort. Accept our sacrifice. Promise us your loyal collaboration. Let us try to make a new start. And if we do, as we try to come closer to one another and try to understand one another, the flame that burned in us at San Francisco will be rekindled, bright and living. Then we can again hope in the destinies of the world. Let us make this new start together. It is not too late. It is not too late, but it is time.
And as the spotlights play upon the marble facade of the Palais de Chaillot, the gleaming hall in Paris, the City of Light, whose walls and galleries this week heard the voices of these men. As the spotlights play, they reveal above the palace portico a verse inscribed as follows.
It depends on him who enters, whether I am tomb or treasure house, whether I speak or am silent. This depends only on you. Friend, do not enter without desire.
It is not too late, said Paul-Henri Spaak. It is not too late, but it is time. May men of goodwill think on this and reckon well. For as George Marshall said,
hope alone is not enough. Living, 1948. Is prepared and presented for the University of the Air by an NBC public affairs staff under the supervision of Wade Arnold. Scripts are by Lou Hazem. Your narrator was Clyde Cattell. Recreating the speeches were Arthur Carney, Leon Janney, Charles Penman, Ivor Francis, and Guy Sorrell. Milton Katims conducted the music. The program was directed by James Harvey. Keep abreast of Living 1948 by listening next week to a request repeat performance of our drama document entitled
Sound Minds, Sound Bodies.
Robert Warren speaking. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.